the oppression of capitalists. And on the other side, the wealthy Western powerhouse, meaning the U.S., was standing on the principles of using capital to create welfare. In the post-war modern era, both rivals tried very hard to win the competition and defeat their tenacious opponent. It was an all-out rivalry, which wasn't very friendly at all. An arms race, the strengthening of military forces and economies, and many other issues had created a battlefield between the two poles, which later became known as the Cold War. It was a time when the East and West would on the surface shake the hands of friendship, but in secret, point their weapons at each other. The Cold War and all its fearsome features took the U.S. and USSR to the brink of war on a number of occasions. But under the shadows of a scary invention, it never turned into an actual armed conflict. It was the dark clouds of nuclear fission and the devastating shadow of the atomic bomb which kept the flames of the Cold War from flaring up. The USSR was doing everything in its power to entice the masses toward communist ideals and turn governments into its allies. Of course, the USSR had to some extent succeeded, and communism was rapidly spreading around the world. Many big and small countries added the Red Star of Communism to their flag and stood with the Eastern camp. Communist ideology was rapidly spreading to weaker countries, and the formidable rival of the USSR had to do something to solve this problem. The U.S. wasn't idly sitting by either. With Truman's four-point program and Kennedy's Peace Corps, it tried to neutralize the USSR's plans.
This corps will be a pool of trained men sent overseas by the United States government or through private institutions and organizations to help foreign countries meet their urgent needs for skilled manpower. We will send Americans abroad who are qualified to do a job. It will not be easy. None of the men and women will be paid a salary. They will live at the same level as the citizens of the country which they're sent to, doing the same work, eating the same food, speaking the same language. We're going to put particular emphasis on those men and women who have skills in teaching, agriculture, and in health.
The fact is, the U.S. wanted to create structural transformation and elevate welfare levels in weaker countries to create a block against the propaganda of the communists. Back then, the U.S. had no bigger goal than combating communism, so it did everything it could to win the hearts of the countries in need and remind them that the country that is truly worried about global welfare is the U.S., not the Soviet Union. But the battle of the Cold War powerhouses, like any other complicated game, had hidden layers which made the battle hotter and hotter. At a time like this, the center of gravity when it comes to global politics and energy, meaning the Middle East, wasn't spared of the game of choosing sides between the East and the West. The region has always been the battleground for global powers. The USSR got to the Middle East sooner than its rival and had won over the hearts of Arab leaders. The Prime Minister of the USSR was an ally of Gamal Abdel Nasser, Egypt's second president. With the help of Abdel Nasser's influence among Arabs in the region, the Soviets wanted to change the color of the map of the Middle East into the red communist star. The Soviets knew that the entrance gate of the Arab world was Egypt and Abdel Nasser. By raising the ideology of pan-Arabism to unite the Arab race, and of course his constant quarrels with its unwanted neighbor, Israel, Nasser had become the hero of Arabs. When Egypt, at the forefront of the Arab world, showed communism the green light, Syria also leaned towards the USSR. Syria had recently united with Egypt and established the United Arab Republic. A short while later, in May 1967, Anwar Sadat, the Speaker of the National Assembly of Egypt, went to Moscow to meet with Soviet Prime Minister Alexei Kosygin. That's where he was told that America's friend, meaning Israel, had gathered a large number of its forces on the Syrian border and the threat of an Israeli attack on the United Arab Republic was serious. The communists were forced to give this mischievous news to Egypt because they thought that a military confrontation between the allies of the East and the West in the Middle East would lead to the victory of the Eastern Bloc.
We believed a war could bring us political gains. Even a stalemate could bring us benefits. Egypt had our backing, both political and military. We thought their forces would demonstrate the benefits of Soviet support. So we were confident that the balance of power in the Middle East would be altered by a localized war.
When Gamal Abdel Nasser received word that Israeli forces had amassed on the Syrian border, he wasted no time. He immediately wrote to the UN and asked the organization to withdraw its peacekeeping forces, which had been stationed on the border of the neighboring countries from the previous war between Egypt and Israel. Nasser wanted to fill up the entire border Egypt had with this unwanted neighbor with his own military forces. It seemed the Soviets' plot for a war between the ideologies of the East and the West in the Middle East had really worked. Nasser took a further step that putting his forces on standby and shut down the strategic straits of Tiran in the Gulf of Aqaba. The Straits of Tiran were the only waterway access Israel had with the eastern part of the world. The only passageway for the Israelis to import fuel had been shut down to the Zionists, and with this, war became inevitable.
Our armed forces are ready for war. The Gulf of Aqaba belongs to Egypt. There is no way that we will allow Israeli ships to pass through. The Jews are threatening war. We tell them hello and welcome. We are ready for war. But there is no way we will give up our rights to the Gulf of Aqaba.
The USSR wanted to prove its friendship to Egypt and, of course, not be left behind from its rival, the U.S., in equipping its allies in the intelligence field. So, it got to work and laid cables on the seabed from the USSR to Egypt. The purpose was to be able to whisper in the ears of the Egyptians anytime it wanted. When the USSR realized that it's too late, and the war will inevitably happen, sooner or later, it ordered its naval forces in the Black Sea to move closer to Egypt's shores. Based on this order, 20 Soviet warships sailed to the east of the Mediterranean and were put on standby position. The USSR didn't want to leave its Arab allies alone in the war against Israel. But on the other front, the US ordered its 6th Fleet based in the Mediterranean to pull back from at least 100 miles from the danger zone, but one of the ships in the 6th Fleet didn't receive the order. As the entire fleet was pulling back, the USS Liberty had received orders to get closer to the Sinai shores. The Liberty was an unarmed naval ship with 45 powerful eavesdropping antennas, tens of advanced data processing and information analysis devices with language experts and professional analysts who were used to listen in on radio communications. The Liberty was getting closer to the crisis region to listen in on what was happening.
If it was broadcast on a radio wave, we could receive it at any frequency, low frequency, high frequency, medium frequency, very low frequency. If it was out there, we could receive it. If we were listening and we heard a signal, and when we looked at it, we couldn't understand it, it was encrypted as well, we'd send it back to NSA and let them hit it with their computers.
The Liberty's confidential messages were radioed to the NSA, the U.S.'s top secret intelligence agency for the analysis and data processing of electric intelligence. On May 22, 1967, and before the beginning of a new mission in the Mediterranean Sea, the Liberty had slowly and steadily left the Norfolk port in the UK for the Guinea Gulf and the Abidjan port in the western shores of Africa. Its mission in this beautiful port in the country of the Ivory Coast was to listen in and find out whether things were going according to the US's liking or not.
We were sent around the world, wherever there might be a hot spot, to see if we could determine what was going on and if the United States desired any intervention of any sort.
The Liberty was leaving Abidjan port as Israeli forces were in military position and getting ready for action. Of course, the Egyptians were based in the Sinai Desert before them. The Israelis preferred for the issue to resolve without military action, because they weren't ready to fight, and on two different fronts, from the southwest with Egypt and the north and east with Syria and Jordan.
I've been asked by my government to explore what these governments intend to do in order to reopen this international waterway to
what
a situation of law.
What do you want the United States to do, sir?
Well, I've come here really to find out what the United States intends to do.
U.S. President Lyndon Johnson asked Israel not to start the war. This is exactly the same thing the USSR told its Arab ally, Egypt, to do. But Egypt had already taken the first step by closing the Straits of Tiran on Israeli ships. Things really got bad when other Arabs joined hands with Abdel Nasser and allied themselves with him in destroying Israel. King Hussein of Jordan was the first to sign a joint defensive alliance with Nasser and put his army under his orders. King Faisal of Saudi Arabia also went to meet with Nasser and pledge him his support. The U.S. wanted to know what secrets about the inevitable war in the Middle East the USSR was whispering in the ears of the Egyptians at any cost. These events were happening as the Liberty was in the Mediterranean and had reached the Rota Naval Station in Spain, so it could add three experts in Russian and Arabic to its crew. In the Israeli camp, the situation was in crisis mode. Egypt from the west, Jordan from the east, and Syria from the north are on standby, awaiting orders from Abdel Nasser to finish Israel off. Levi Eshkol, the Israeli prime minister, thought of a surprise attack as the only way to end the crisis and informed his new defense minister, Moshe Dayan, of his opinion. June 5, 1967, was chosen as the day to attack the Arabs. June 5th, 7 in the morning, 180 Israeli fighter jets flew towards Egypt. Only 12 fighter jets were left behind to defend the Israeli skies. Forty-five minutes later, Egypt's military airport runways were bombed, and 280 Egyptian military jets on the ground were the targets of Israeli rockets. The Egyptians were so overwhelmingly surprised that they didn't even find the time to start their jet engines.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Today we listen to the speech of Hujjatul Islam Salim Yusuf Ali.
Ma'mun al-Rashid was one of the Abbasid Khulafa. He was somebody who, just like his forefathers, they were not people of God. They were people of the dunya. They were pleasure seekers. They were very keen on living the life. They were very keen on having power over others. So why would the Imam Ali ibn Musa Rida, in a way, associate himself? Why would he agree to become the Waliul Ahd? And if we understand some points about this, we can understand more about the Imam's life, inshallah. But I want to first introduce this concept, which is known as soft power versus hard power. I think you probably have heard this term before. Sometimes it's used as like soft war, or you could say hard war. What is the difference between these? Hard power is when you force somebody to do something. You know, imagine that, you know, like you have a donkey, so you put a carrot in front of it. And you say that, okay, you have to walk and you have to go to a certain place. And if it doesn't go where you want to, then you take a stick and you beat the donkey. That's an exercise of hard power. Soft power is different. Soft power is where you want to use someone for your purposes. So by attacking them and beating them and doing things, you know, in an open way, then they're not going to go the way that you want. You want to use them, but for your purposes. So what do you use? You use subtlety. You use different ways of, you know, kind of tricking them and getting them to do what you want to do. Okay, this is something that we should all be familiar with. Why? Because we have an enemy who is the shaitan. And you know that shaitan rarely uses hard power tactics in order to come and trick us. Right? How often have you had shaitan come and threaten you, you know, with like, you know, a vision of the hellfire? Right? It doesn't happen typically to most people. In fact, shaitan rarely even appears to most people in his original form. But what does he use? What techniques does shaitan use? It's a very interesting topic to study and to learn about. And after all, it's something that is one of the most important things to learn about. That what techniques does the enemy use in order to swerve us away from being righteous and being good believers. In the Quran, Allah describes the shaitan, for example, as using false promises. Look, the shaitan will present things which are evil and make them look as if they're good and inviting and attractive. The shaitan will distract somebody from their purpose. And when they're distracted, then he will get them to swerve away from what they're, and forget about what their whole purpose was all about. Now, Ma'mun al-Rashid, who was the Khalifa during the last 5 years of the Imam's life, he was somebody who was very skilled in the dark arts of the shaitan. And he was in a position where he had to gain power over the people, and he saw that the only way he could do that was by making Imam Ridha alayhi salam somewhat of an ally, making Imam Ridha somehow join him. But how could he do it in a way where Imam Ridha wouldn't become the Imam? He still wanted to hold power. He wanted to use the Imam. He wanted to make sure that, you know, the Shias and those who were supporting the Imam, that they wouldn't attack him, because he knew that his government was weak. So what does he use? He uses soft power techniques. He needs the Imam, but he wants to use him and sort of try to almost trick him and trick his followers and trick the people in general. Now the Imam alayhi salam, of course, is ma'asum. We heard it in this hadith of the Prophet, where the Prophet says in the dream of Imam's father, he says that your son, yusibu wa la yukhtib, your son will always do isabatul haq, he will always arrive at the truth, he won't make an error. The Imam was gifted with nurullah, insight. He wasn't fooled with politics and with games. So Ma'mun al-Rashid, when he comes to the Imam and he says that, you know, he sends the message, okay, I want you to be the Khalifa. That's the approach that he takes. Now, why don't you come and you be the Khalifa? Now, what is the response of the Imam? It's very interesting. The Imam alayhi salam tells him that, well, Ma'mun, if being a Khalifa is something that is appointed by Allah, and you are the Khalifa right now, then it's not your right to take that position and to gift it to somebody else, because after all, it's something from Allah. And if it's not from Allah, then what right do you have to go and give it to somebody else? You see, what is he doing here? He's not telling Ma'mun directly everything that he knows about him, and he's not revealing to him everything that he knows about his agenda. But indirectly, he's telling Ma'mun al-Rashid that you know and I know that truly leadership in the ummah is not something which is determined by the people. It's not for somebody to stand and say that, okay, because I have the power, I inherited it from my father and from my brother, and I won the politics and I won out the political game, therefore I have a right to exercise power. That's not the way things work. It's something from Allah. And the Imam alayhi salam is telling him that, I know this game that you're playing right here. Later, the Imam alayhi salam accepts to be the Waliul Ahad, the one who's sort of next in line. Now, Ma'mun is never successful in tricking the Imam. The Imam is very aware. But what about the Shias? When they see that the Imam alayhi salam is aligning himself supposedly, and he's joining the government of the enemy, what are they supposed to say? What are they supposed to do? This is where the Shias were tested. They were tested to see that when your fundamental, one of your core beliefs about the Imam is that he is ma'asum, he will not make an error. When you see him doing something which brings a question to your mind, what are you going to do? Are you going to be somebody who breaks off from the Imam? Or are you going to have firm faith that what the Imam does is correct? And are you going to seek clarification? One of the amazing things we see in history, brothers and sisters, is that those people who accepted the Imamah of Imam Ridha alayhi salam, they stayed with Imam Ridha alayhi salam until he became a shaheed. And they stayed with his son. And they stayed with Hassan and finally all the way to the Imam of the time. We don't find groups splitting away from Imam Ridha alayhi salam. Imam Ridha, those who were with him, they stuck with him till the end. This is one of the amazing miracles of Imam Ridha alayhi salam. And it had to do with the strategy that he took. The Shia at his time, they were tested, but they passed the test. One of the really interesting examples we have of this is where Abu Salat, one of the companions of Imam Ridha alayhi salam, he goes to him and he says that, Imam, people are talking. Now that you've accepted this position, they're saying that before we thought that the Imam alayhi salam was zahid from the dunya. We thought that he was staying away from it. He had no interest in it. But now we're realizing that maybe it was the case, or we're thinking that maybe it's the case that no, that was just by chance that the dunya stayed away from him. But now he's thinking, na'udhu billah, then maybe the dunya is coming to him. What response can we give them? So what does the Imam do? He lays it out for them. He says that, Abu Salt, you should know that I was in a position where I had a choice between two things. One of them was to be killed. The other one was to accept this position and to see what I can do with it. How can I use this position for good? And I took as an example, and there's an example in the Quran for you which you can refer to, which is the example of Nabi Yusuf alayhi salam. Because Nabi Yusuf, and then the Imam has some quotes from them in the Quran. The Nabi Yusuf was in a position where he told the leader at the time, the leader of Egypt, he says that, make me be the one who is in charge of the treasuries of the earth. I want to be in charge. Because I am somebody who is knowledgeable and I am somebody who is capable. So you see, Nabi Yusuf alayhi salam was part of a government of shirk. But he made use of that position to spread the word of Allah. And that was my position as well too. I had to choose between the lesser of two evils. And it's because of that, it's not something out of my own choice that here I am, na'udhu billah, trying to profit from the dunya, that I've changed my stance or anything like that. So the Shias, with these types of guidance from the Imam, they remain firm in their position. They knew that the Imam alayhi salam was doing what he did and he was there for a purpose.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahim Karim Adi Ali. حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Lovely listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of Muslim Lady. In the studio with me, I have the privilege and honor of being joined by Sister Salma Khalfan. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
Thank you so very much for being with us, sharing your time with us.
The pleasure is mine.
Thank you. During these last few episodes of Muslim Lady, we've been discussing the identity of a mother and how it's important for any mother, especially a Muslim lady, to find, to rediscover, refind in a way, the value within that identity that Allah has bestowed upon her through nature. Now, today, talking about value, obviously there's a strength that can be drawn from that, right? And Sister Salma, if you could just explain to us through which route does Islam give this strength to a Muslim lady? Because for the past, I would say, 300, 400-ish years, there's been this common misconception and misinterpretation of Islam and the practices a Muslim lady has within her religion, that, oh, Islam oppresses women and it does the complete opposite of empowering them, and it cages them and it degrades them and it's constantly forcing them to cover themselves and hide away in their homes and this and that. So when you say that if Islam gives them strength, you know, that's such a bold statement to be making. And how do we defend that? Because how does that happen?
First of all, we can see that Islam gives many rights to women. That is an empowerment in itself.
For sure.
Right? So the law of creation has made men and women in need of each other. In order to better unite men and women together and strengthen the family. The family is the main thing that actually unites this, the men and women, and gives strength to the woman. So this is the main basis of human prosperity. If men have been established as the ones for the women to financially rely on, women have been created for men to spiritually rely on.
Beautiful.
You know, so this empowers her, actually. A woman has so many tasks, but when she brings peace around her family, then she has actually done the best task ever, because she's given peace to her husband and she's given peace to her children around her. Also, and the children are the future leaders also. So we have to see that this woman is empowered, but sometimes she has to combat with herself a lot in the process, because she sees her husband as her friend and her, you know, like a partner to be so close to, not realizing the fact that there's an element of respect there to establish this power in her, if she wants to maintain that power, to keep it long-lasting, to not let go of, you know, to not lose her respect in front of her husband. So that will actually make her gain the power. And family is, the family issues, will, as we'll keep on looking at it, really provides a ground for her to get this power.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And she has to look at it like that, you know.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to Muslim Lady. We are going to go for a short break, so stay tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Said that if she relies on her man for financial support, then her man and her family basically
rely on her for spiritual support and for that serenity that they so very much require in order to be able to function in this world, really. But what if that peace and serenity comes at her own expense? Who does the woman turn to for that peace that she obviously so very much needs as well?
Well, you know what? This is a plan that she has to undergo, first of all, through spouse selection. She can't just say that now, you know, like there are many people out there who are suffering because of the spouses are not compatible with them. And, you know, the blame is probably on the parents as well to have selected such spouses for them. In olden days time, you see, people were not given that much value and importance, that they could select their spouses themselves. Sometimes it gets out of hand in this day and time also, because people, they don't want to get married. And they keep on lagging behind. And probably they want Mr. Perfect to come along. And then they see that they've lost.
That
the age
exist.
Has gone by. So it's very important to have a balance in that, to have the elders' consent also here, as well as your own. The advice of the elders is very important. So when you see that in the case that you have asked that, you know, then whom should she turn to? It's actually her own fault. Now she has to learn how to be more patient. She has to grow
it.
Or she can choose
own.
Another way. If she's so much in the intermediary level, like the barzakh, that she can't escape, then she should divorce. She knows that she's getting the worst of her, you know, her life. Then she should just separate.
Walk away, walk away.
If she knows that there are valid reasons, though.
Right.
Very valid reasons. But if they are just like in between, then she should improve herself. She should like maintain the power, as we will keep on seeing what are the requirements to build that power in her. That power is so beautiful that it's not like a physical power that you feel that, okay, your man is more powerful, he can give you security, he can give you money, he can provide for you. You are powerless. It's not the real power, if you go and see, is
for
it?
Sure, yes.
Like, does the zahiri things, the apparent things give you that power? No, the power is within the soul. That when you empower a person spiritually and emotionally, that's when you see that the man of the house has, like, a very good state of mind, and he can do more for the woman
exactly.
in turn. Yeah, but the woman has to be clever enough, the Muslim lady has to be clever enough to regard these things in her life, not to take it lightly. And the first aspect is the respect that should be given to her husband.
It's so important for a Muslim lady to understand that feminine energy she has within herself and to channel it in a way that demands respect, not in like a dictator abusive sort of way, but the way she carries herself at home and in front of her spouse.
I'm talking about the respect she should also give to her
absolutely,
spouse.
Absolutely, yes. It's a two-way
then she earns
road.
It,
yeah, for sure. When you were talking about empowering, it reminded me of all those women that I've seen around myself that were able to channel that feminine energy Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has rightfully blessed them with, and were able to earn the respect of their spouse by respecting him in return. And then they really wielded a sort of power that could really make or break that man, that family, that community even.
Yeah.
And that is such a powerful thing to be able to do, you know?
It depends on the way she's brought up or the things that she learns in her life, that she can now apply this respect, what she saw from her parents. It's very important. So upbringing comes here up, you know, like together.
Yes.
So how she was brought up, then she can even give that same respect to the husband. How she was taught the values of how to, you know, enter a family. The values are very important, that she should be taught that, you know, when you enter a family life, don't be so like, you know, like free in your own like world that you think that, okay, now I have a life partner and I can do anything, like I can say anything to him. And I
being
can,
impulsive.
She should have the hut that would do, those limits should be there. Like treating any human being, for
absolutely,
that matter, you know?
Yeah.
Like when we even treat our mother, we are close to our mothers, our parents, but we are so respectful too, right?
Yes.
And that earns us more respect in turn and more sawabs in turn. So a parent, I mean, a wife should be careful on these things. When she's about to enter the marriage contract, she should know that adab is very important. Adab, the best, you know, like heritage that a parent can give to a child is adab.
Mm.
Adab of how to treat your husband, adab of how to react, as in like in anger and frustration or thinking whatever you want to say because he's my, you know, life partner, my spouse. I can say anything to him. Yeah, share with him. Have secrets with him, whatever. But maintain the respect. Know that he's a man and he has an ego and he needs to maintain his ego. Otherwise, if you break that ego, then the life will be broken.
Mm-hmm.
A man likes that he is the head of the family.
Yeah.
It is in his fitrat to feel that he wants to have the power. So you should respect him for that. And that will earn you respect in turn.
For sure, it's a beautiful thing
that they will earn so much respect in turn that decision making will be even done with their consent.
Mm.
And in a subtle way, a woman can get whatever she wants, you know. The scholar said that a woman is so smart, she can get whatever she wants.
Yeah, exactly.
So I guess with this respect, it's good qualities,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, if she's tactful enough, she can definitely do that. Do you think, from your experience of working with so many families in the community, that is it the case that if a woman does not pick up those skills from her family, because some families are really broken, then if she enters her family, then they're doomed and there's no hope for her? Or there is hope that perhaps she can learn from a certain stage onwards? Would you recommend couple counseling? Are these things helpful at all? And whether she can turn a new leaf to not repeat that vicious cycle of abusive families?
Yes, of course. They're all doors are open, you know, for improvement. So if she feels, and she, you know, naturally a woman gets unhappy when she sees that there's no satisfaction in life going wrong with the family. And she will do something about it. But there are different ways to, you know, like do it. For example, she might just read about it. Or she might not have that strong initiative to keep on doing it, you know, that will.
Mm-hmm.
She might do it for a day or two and see the repercussions. And if she keeps on dragging the same attitude, then of course, khasira dunya wal akhirah, she is lost in this world and the hereafter. But if she's smart enough, yes, she'll go for counseling. She will see what to do about it. She will also practice 1-2 in her agenda of how to go about it. And she will learn the hard way, I guess.
Oh, yeah.
You see? But she has to learn. And we've seen many people doing that, huh? Like, I know of many olden folk who have actually, you know, like, gone to marriages that are very unsuccessful. But they're doing sabr. They're like, you know, they've come up beautifully in their summer. They know that their partners are not compatible with them because they were not rightly selected in the first place. That's why spouse selection is of paramount importance. Very important. Think about it properly and then pros and cons and go forward if it's the right partner. In spite of all these difficulties along the lines, you will see that they've done their summer. They've given in. They have, you know, like, struggled, they have had so much patience, and then they get it through their children, or they get that appreciation in the end. Maybe they feel like sometimes that you see the one of the spouse getting sick and they're serving the sick spouse, and the man realizes what he did, you know, was wrong.
Yeah.
And he does toba in the end. So now he or she is also the winner, and so is the husband, because he's done toba, right? He's regretted and he's turned to Allah, and Allah is the all merciful. He loves the tawabin. You see? So it's not like that there's a, you know, dead end in Islam. No, there's no dead end. And there are all the ways to search for. And, you know, now we have, everything is so open and replete. The world has become like a village.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, counseling, asking, seeking advice from elders, improving yourself. You know, the nafs is something that is like, if it lets go, it can create disaster.
Yes.
So that nafs is like a nafs al-lawama. Everybody has that. You know, لا أقسم بالنفس اللوامة, لا أقسم بيوم القيامة ولا أقسم بالنفس اللوامة. The نفس اللوامة is a judgment in you to make. Like, so it'll tell you this, you're wrong, this is not right. In that process, if a person who is educated and wise enough, they'll think that I'm wrong in this way.
That's very important. You're right. And that's definitely something we're going to touch upon in further episodes of Muslim Lady. But that's all the time we have for today. Thank you so very much for being with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something, something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's episode, we're discussing The Reagan Show, directed by Pacho Velez and Sierra Patton-Gill. And joining me in this episode are Lee Singer, who is a film journalist and video essayist, whose work has appeared in various major newspapers, magazines, and online outlets. And beside him is Neil Faulkner, who is a historian, writer, and author, and has a new edition of his book coming out soon, which is called A Radical History of the World. Now, made up entirely of archive news and White House footage, The Reagan Show is a documentary that captures the pageantry, absurdity, and mastery of the made-for-TV politics of Ronald Reagan during his two terms in office as the 40th president of the US. This documentary shows how the former Hollywood actor redefined the look and feel of what it means to be in the highest office in the world, and also his rivalry with former Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev during the Cold War era.
Okay, recording.
The Reagan administration will be remembered for excelling in public relations.
I think that he has captured the imagination of the American people because of his ability to communicate.
To be prepared for war is one of the most effectual means of preserving the peace.
That's why New Hampshire needs John Sununu. Sununu.
Together, we'll make America great again.
I think appearance is very important, but it's also staging. It's how you stage the message.
Not for me, honey.
It's a game.
That's it.
Super!
Well, if you'll pardon my stealing a film line, the force is with us.
You have stated flatly that you did not trade weapons for hostages.
What began as a strategic opening to Iran deteriorated in its implementation.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
Happy New Year. Thank you. And God bless you.
Cut.
Take that, Mr. Gorbachev.
So first of all, thanks for coming on. Very much welcome to the show. And I found this documentary to be incredibly an eye-opening insight into the superficial sort of role of the president in the U.S. And also, I suppose this documentary comes at a fitting time as we see many parallels between Trump and Reagan. And Lee, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on this documentary?
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating sort of behind-the-scenes look. It's got that inbuilt nostalgia factor. I mean, Reagan himself kind of very much based his own persona on this kind of, you know, folksy, you know, bygone era charms, you know, referring back to his Hollywood career before he was a politician. And the film because it's got that sort of, you know, the videotape and the sort of grainy look and everything, it's almost an inbuilt kind of nostalgia trip for anyone who remembers him from that time. I think as a film, because it sort of sticks so closely to the sort of found footage and you know, commentary from the time, it allows viewers to make parallels. So, you know, in the trailer, you see Reagan saying, "Make America Great Again," which obviously we have more modern connotations to today. But it doesn't give you that sort of perspective of people commenting back from now to then, mm-hmm. and sort of maybe shaping a bit more the narrative of how we went from this sort of, you know, maybe more substance-driven thing to a more sort of style and, you know, pageantry and performance thing. So I understand why they've done it, and within the confines of the structure and the style that they use, it works. But there's a wider story that maybe would allow for more kind of, you know, nuance and reflection on how we got to that point.
Mm-hmm. But perhaps the onus of the documentary and the perspective is on the rests in the audience to figure out what's happening using the archive. You're forced to be guided through it, really, because without
Absolutely.
The narration.
No, for sure. I mean, you know, it's very much, you know, it puts there and it's asking you, so, you know, how does that resonate today? And obviously there's a huge amount. It's like, you know, now it's Reagan on steroids, you know, because it's not just old style Hollywood production, it's social media, which is a whole different world, but reflects, you know, it's gone from that and it's sort of metastasized into something even more pernicious perhaps. Mm-hmm. But I still think that there's an element there that what I would love to see, it's always, you know, you should never review the film that isn't made, but I would love to see him, how he went from actor to politician, mm-hmm. and used the media and the performance idea of that. It kind of starts, it's already fully formed. Mm-hmm. And we don't get a lot of analysis of how he became that, you know, ready-made image mm-hmm. of a president.
So, Neil, if I could bring you in here, that was a good point that Lee made. How did you find this documentary?
Well, I agree with everything that Lee has just said, and I think for me as a historian, the problem with it is, and as you say, we shouldn't be criticising the documentary that wasn't made, but the reality is that if you focus on the image, and the image was very, very powerful politically, it was very, very effective politically, because that avuncular, friendly, warm, genial, round the log fire, all American kind of image that was being very successfully promoted was a cover for a range of policies which were really quite pernicious. I mean, massive union busting operation going on, a driving down of wages, massive cuts to the poor, huge shifts in terms of tax cuts for the rich. So the poor were being penalized with benefit cuts while the rich were getting richer through the tax cuts. And this massive increase in military spending.
That's a really interesting point, and I want to delve into that issue a bit later on in the show.
We were riding to the airport yesterday afternoon, and my mother was talking about in Arkansas that they were trying to pass a law to give 150 or pay people standing in their homes instead of going to the old folks' home. I made the comment, I said, I didn't think it should give anything. I thought we should take care of our own, you know. That's my feelings. My little one, I thought, was asleep in the back seat, and he raised up, and he said, "Granny, that's why Ronald Reagan's the president. Stop all these giveaway programs."
Tell me, you had the experience, Mr. President, at one time of auditioning for film roles, and then when you ran for governor and president, you were auditioning in front of the public for office. Which is more difficult?
Well, I have to say this one is, you have to, well, you not only have to get the part, you have to write the script.
And Neil, there's a moment in the documentary also that's quite revealing, and we see the mask slip a bit when we see that Reagan admits that it was actually easier to be an actor than it is to be a president. Mm. And he also says that he couldn't imagine being a president without being an actor also. What do you think the film implies then about the suitability of his character for president?
Well, I think to a very large extent anyway, the American president is very often a figurehead who's controlled by other forces. I mean, I don't think Reagan was particularly bright. I don't think he was particularly well informed. He's supposed to have had a reputation for being very impatient of detail. I don't think he was a particularly quick thinker and so on. So I think we need to see him as, I mean, in a sense, the documentary is capturing this, isn't it? That he's the front man, he's the image, he's the folksy image. and the real hard policy is being decided by other people. And it was brutal policy, both domestically and in relation to what the US was doing internationally. So, yes, you could say the image is a construct, and he's quite a shallow figure, but hey, does that make any difference to the Reagan project actually being driven through by this administration? Because it was being driven through very effectively.
And Lee, what did you make of how this character, Reagan, was portrayed in this documentary?
Well, I mean, you know, I think with the best will in the world, even the biggest Ronald Reagan fans would not give him much credit as an actor. But he is uniquely suited for this sort of role because, as Neil says, he's got the best, you know, when he was a Hollywood actor, he never worked necessarily with the best filmmakers. Mm-hmm. When he's president, he's working with the very best people to stage and produce the theater that's going on. And he's got that sort of, I mean, you know, I watched this very carefully. I don't think there's a moment where he's not smiling, or at least he never looks unhappy. Mm-hmm. He's always got that kind of, the lights are on, you know, I'm on stage, you know, and you saw him in the clip before, he ushers people towards the mic. He's so aware of, you know, his role within the production. So he succeeds so much better as a president than he ever did as an actor, mm-hmm. and that's fascinating to me, because you would think one has a lot bigger stakes and is a lot, you know, you need a much better, you know, person at the job to succeed as president, but actually a sort of very average to mediocre actor mm-hmm. can, you know, whether you agree with the policies or not, be a very successful president in terms of putting his message across.
That is really interesting, and we do learn that actually he's been in 53 Hollywood movies or so.
It's a film about Reagan's years in office and looking at those years through the lens of PR, and in particular how he used PR and public relations to fight the Cold War.
There.
By making a film that let you watch Reagan go from his roles in Hollywood eventually to the presidency, you'd sort of see how his work in Hollywood informed his performance as a politician. So I found this archive called the White House Television Archive that was commissioned and overseen by the Reagan administration. 2,000 hours of footage documenting Reagan's time in office. So Reagan was the subject of the archive, but he was also kind of its author. So as I'm making this film, sometimes I like to joke that Reagan's actually, in some ways, deserves a co-director credit.
So Neil, I just wanted to ask you to shed more political context on Reagan during the time. What was the political landscape like, and why was he elected?
I think there's a huge shift going on in the 1970s. The 1970s is a period of major crisis inside a lot of Western states, where there's a wave of radicalization, of union struggle, advances by social movements and so on. And also internationally, US imperialism was on the back foot. In the 1970s, it suffered a series of very significant setbacks. The defeat in Vietnam, losing ground in Southern Africa, losing ground in Central Asia, losing ground in Central America as well, with the Nicaraguan Revolution at the end of the 1970s. And I think Reagan represents two things. He represents a kind of counterattack by the corporations and the rich inside America, against workers, against the poor, and against the social movements, and internationally, an attempt to reassert US imperial control over what is effectively an informal empire. They want to shore up US power at a time when the US economy is weakening, and that weakening of economic clout, which had been crucial to US power in the 50s and the 60s, to some degree you can compensate for that by substituting a more aggressive military stance. And I think that's what's happening under Reagan.
And in this documentary, you learn that he was called a trigger-happy president. Although he said he strived for peace, we saw sort of contradictions there.
Yes. No, that's absolutely right, because there's this massive, massive increase in arms expenditure, which brings it right up to the level that it was at the beginning of the Cold War in the early 1950s. And it creates a huge economic problem for the United States, a massive